Hello, and welcome to Star Wars Sleepover, a laid-back exploration of the captivating and sometimes ridiculous galaxy far, far away. I'm Europa Tokani, and I am here with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Loya Rowan. This show will be discussing the book Queen's Shadow by E.K. Johnston, and I might be renouncing my stance as a prequel hater as a result. Let's do this.
So Queen's Shadow came out a little over a year ago in March 2019, and this is both my and Loya's first time reading it. So we did so separately, and then we both came up with some questions that we wanted to discuss together on the podcast. So this will be more of a thematic discussion and less of a summary or a recap of the book overall. But before we get into that, we're going to get into our drinks.
Okay, so it's time once again for our Cantina Corner segment. Each week we will be choosing a cocktail to make for ourselves to enjoy during our sleepover discussion. And we are each choosing a different cocktail and then telling one another a little bit about it. And we will also share the recipes on our website and share some pictures on our Instagram. So this week I made myself a Qui-Gon gin and tonic, which really is essentially a gin and tonic, but with elderflower liqueur. I chose it not only because I wanted to make an elderflower liqueur cocktail, but also because I thought it was fitting to bring Qui-Gon into our discussion, because I thought it was very interesting the number of times that Padme mentioned him over the course of the book. And in my opinion, she seemed oddly fixated on him, given their somewhat limited time together. And she also, I don't think, mentioned Obi-Wan once. And I know, Loya, you did a search to see if there was actually anywhere that Obi-Wan was mentioned, and you didn't find any, right?
Right. Yeah, it wasn't until the very end with Sabe that she mentions Obi-Wan. Although, in my defense, or I guess in the book's defense, she does refer to Jedi by monikers, like Qui-Gon's the long-haired Jedi, so it's entirely possible it might be, like, his apprentice Jedi or something that I wasn't looking for.
So, I know that Padme, a few times when she was talking about Qui-Gon, said that Naboo considered him to be a hero because he helped fight with them against the invaders, and I totally get that, but I just I didn't expect her to make reference to Qui-Gon like 10 times.
The long-haired Jedi.
The way that she spoke about the Jedi in general was also very interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, she seemed fascinated by them, but also seemed to think that they were just like very bizarre. So I actually bookmarked a quote, and this was when she had first arrived on Coruscant, and she was going past the Jedi Temple, and so there's a mention that she put her hand to her necklace that Anakin had given to her, which, like, also all of her mentions of Anakin seem to be explicitly connected to the necklace, which is interesting. But in any case, she is talking about how a lot of the new senators had decided to go and see the Jedi Temple, and she had an interesting reaction. So this is a quote. I don't know what page it's on, honestly, because I have a Kindle version of the book, and I had it as page 74, but that probably doesn't correspond to other versions of the book. In any case, it is when she first arrives on Coruscant, and I'll just read a part of the quote. Unlike most of her colleagues, she had met several Jedi already, and she found their manner unsettling. Perhaps if Master Qui-Gon had lived, she would feel differently. She would certainly be pleased to call him a friend, and they would have been hopeful to treat with him as an ally. Theirs had been an odd relationship. She hadn't fooled him for a moment, but he had a allowed her to continue fooling everyone else, which she had appreciated as a help preserve her own life. She knew she was not the only person on Naboo who lit a stick of incense for him at the yearly memorial for those who had fallen in defense of the planet.
Jeez.
I don't know. I just feel like she has a lot of complicated thoughts and feelings around Jedi, and especially around Qui-Gon. So.
Yeah. Agreed. There was one that I thought that you were going to mention where they were just like, she was talking about meeting a different Jedi, and she's just like, they're sentient. Just an odd.
Oh, yes. I think I actually do have that quote.
Yes.
Let's see. Yes, I do. So this I have on being on page 290 in my version. And yes, I have exactly that quote bookmarked. The first time I saw a Jedi, I was running for my life, she said. It gets a bit easier when you remember they're still sentient beings like us. They just say strange things from time to time.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating.
And then she's also real weird about that Jedi that is with her on...
Yeah, Deepa?
The planet that they go to like help them with their disaster response.
Yeah, Deepa Balaba.
Yeah, she also just like thinks that that woman is super weird.
It's interesting because like of everything else that goes on in Star Wars, like the Jedi seem like relatively, I mean, a little mystical, sure, but like there's so much else going on. It's weird that she like specifically flags them as unsettling.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if I have ever responded to Jedi in that way, but I totally get them being unusual or people not seeing them often or people feeling that they're mystical or something that's outside their normal realm of experience. But just the fact that she spent, again, pretty limited amount of time with Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan and just, like, produces all of these feelings and thoughts about the Jedi.
Yeah.
Just makes me think about it in the context of Anakin.
He's so unsettling.
I mean...
He's sentient. We know he's sentient. Yeah.
So, low like, bar. How does she feel about the fact that Anakin becomes a Jedi? It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point.
But anyway, that is... those are my thoughts on Qui-Gon and the Jedi in Queen Shadow. And they inspired me to make the Qui-Gon gin tonic. So I am going to go ahead and try it. And it is delicious, as expected.
Yeah, I feel like it would be. I am less sure about mine.
I should also mention the drink itself is not visually appealing at all because it's, again, basically a gin tonic. So I didn't make it in a transparent glass. Instead, I made it in my Jawa Geeky Tiki mug, which I recently bought and am just using whenever I possibly can, because it just makes me very happy.
It makes me happy. I don't even have it. All right. So I am drinking an Imperial Stardust cocktail by the website Kegworks. In my usual, I guess, now usual fashion, I had to make some adjustments because I could simply not find Star Anise anywhere. So this one is tequila, chartreuse, lime juice, and then it's supposed to be a 1/4 ounce Star Anise simple syrup. So in lieu of that, I just use absinthe because of the anise flavor. Mine is also not visually appealing. Well, now that it's been sitting for a while, it's definitely not visually appealing. There's like bits of lime juice currently floating around. So the website is actually very clever. Like they have really cool, like, spherical ice is the Death Star of frozen water. It's tequila based because then you can drink another one on Revenge of the Fifth, aka May 5th, and still be Cinco de Mayo compliant. Cheers. And then it features star anise and the simple syrup and the garnish because space. So sadly, I missed that particular component, but we'll see how the absinthe tastes in as a substitute. It's not visually appealing at all. All right. Oh, that is better than I thought it would be. I think I probably put too much absinthe in there because it's very overwhelming. But the tequila tastes nice. And the lime juice. All right, that's a sipper.
Nice. I feel like I'm going to drink mine too quickly because it's just...
It sounds delicious.
It's good. Good, and it's, I mean, I made a double because why not? But it's not, I mean, it doesn't taste strong or overwhelmingly like alcohol, so it is good.
Yeah, mine burns a little. one of these episodes, I will get the perfect balance between not strong enough and too strong. It appears that that is still in progress.
All right. Well, I am excited to get into the book and to start the first part of our discussion about Padme. So cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, so first of all, before we actually start talking about Queen Shadow in depth, just a warning, if you haven't read the book, and then also actually if you haven't read or are not familiar with the current Darth Vader comic, there will definitely be plot spoilers for Queen Shadow, and there may be plot spoilers for the few issues of that Darth Vader comic that have been released, because I myself personally want to talk about them. So just be aware of that. If you don't want to hear spoilers for either of those two things, you might want to skip this episode. But otherwise, let's get started. So Loya, I want to know, first of all, what your overall thoughts on the book are, especially because you said that you think you have relegated your views as a prequel hater to the past. So definitely want to get into that.
I liked it. Overall, the book I felt was pretty solid. There are some weird moments, like it was hard to emotionally relate to the characters. For instance, Sabe becoming romantically involved with Tanra. Thank you. I was like, that is not correct. One of these times, I will also get all the names right. I feel like if I had been maybe younger or things had been written differently, like that would have been, you could sense a buildup, like as they become more and more together, like spend more and more time together. Like it was a very like foreshadowed romance, and when it happened, I was like, okay, I don't care. So the emotional connections weren't there, but it did, the political aspect was fascinating to me, and I am actually intrigued and excited to watch the prequels again, just because I was keeping track of all these different characters on my cheat sheets in preparation for this podcast, and I actually want to see more about them. Like, probably should have written their names down. But Mon Mothra?
Mon Mothma?
Yes. See, Mothra?
Mon Mothra.
Mothra versus Godzilla. It was really interesting to read more about her. And
okay, so wait.
Yeah.
Sorry. I interrupted you, but I just want to pause you there for a second.
I would love to.
So you know who Mon Mothma is, right?
Yes. Okay. I do now.
Okay, but you know she was in the original trilogy.
Yes.
Okay.
Like now.
Like as of this moment?
No. Okay. It looked up when I was reading
Queen
Shadow.
All right. Please proceed.
Yes. I should have written names down. I'm doing that next time because seriously, the stumbling over names is frustrating for me. Yeah. So I actually did not realize when I was reading this who she was. I was like, okay, let's look up more about her, what she like. And I'm like, oh, wait, so this is probably something I probably should have realized. So that was interesting to me. I am excited to watch Clone Wars now because there were references to characters in that as well, including Mon Mothma.
Yes.
Mothma. Seriously, I just want to say Mothma. Okay, so yeah, that's what I really liked about it, is like the political aspects, and then like the fleshing out of characters and kind of the backstories around the handmaidens were all very interesting to me. Mothma.
So I think I have some views in common with you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did like learning about all those characters, and actually my motivation or one of my main motivations behind reading this book was the hope of having a chance to kind of get to know Padme a little bit better.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I have not necessarily connected strongly with her as the character based on the movies. And I really liked having a chance to see what she was doing in between the movies and learn more about her political career, and also to see her kind of divorced from her context of being with Anakin, like whether it be their romantic relationship later on or just her connection to him, because I do feel like that really overshadows a lot when it comes to Padme. A lot of what we see of her is all about how she relates to or is connected to Anakin. Mm-hmm. So I did definitely appreciate seeing her in a different context. However, I would say that I did end up liking other characters more than Padme.
Really?
So I don't know if it was totally successful in that regard, because I thought most of the handmaidens were more interesting than she was, especially Sabe. And
interesting.
Also really liked getting to see Mon Mothma at an earlier point and would love to see more of her. And also, I am now pretty much obsessed with Brea Organa, which we can talk about a little bit later. But I thought they all were more interesting than Padme. Padme has risen in my esteem. Like, I feel like I do understand her a bit more, but she still is not my favorite, and she just wasn't my preference even among the other characters that were in the book.
That is fascinating, because like I was reading up on E.K. Johnston, and she wrote the book because she essentially said Padme was her doctor, as a reference to Doctor Who. Like, Padme was the character she connected with as a kid because they were like more or less the same age. And she was so excited to write about her because she felt this connection. And I obviously did not at all feel that. But reading this, like, I like Padme a lot. I'm trying to think if there was any character I liked more than her. That's interesting.
I did really like, too, this is interesting, because you said that you didn't really connect to the relationships or the emotional connections between characters, because that was one of the things that I would say I liked about the book.
Oh. Is that
I think the relationships were well done, and I really actually liked the relationship between Sabe and Tanra, and I also really liked seeing female friendships depicted in Star Wars, which is rare.
Yeah,
and I think that was very true to life, and it just was nice to see.
Yep, I'm like, Sabe and Padme was the exception to that emotional connection. Like, I felt that friendship in a way that like the others just didn't really compare. Very interesting.
And then I also did feel like all of the political intrigue was kind of easier to follow than it is in the prequels, at least for me, and I also appreciated getting more context behind that and what was going on in the Senate and just generally. I think that will enrich my viewing of the prequels.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Like, I'm actually excited to watch Attack of the Clones now, because I feel like I'm more interested in more of what was going on in the Senate because of this book versus before, where that particular one is so hard for me.
I know you put together a list of discussion topics, which thank you for that. They're all very good. And I thought maybe we would just kind of go through them, and I'll ask you to share your thoughts first, and then I will add mine. The first thing that you have was pros and cons, which I think we kind of talked about a little bit. I would say my other major con would be that I thought it just ended very abruptly.
Yes.
And in a very weird place.
Yeah. And I'm surprised, like, After I finished reading this, I immediately went to see if another book was coming out, and there is, but it's a prequel to this one. Yeah, and I'm like, why?
Right. So I was like, I want a sequel to this, yes. But the book that just came out, like literally very recently, is a prequel about the handmaid prior to this, like when Padme first became queen.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting choice. And I was trying to, I actually wanted to ask you, like, one of my questions is, have canon books already been written about Padme and Anakin's relationship? Like, are there books out there that's talking more about them? Like, whether those are graphic novels or comics?
I don't think so. I don't want to say 100% there aren't, because I don't know for sure. And it's not something that I've specifically looked into. I know that there is a Revenge of the Sith novelization, which I have heard is really well done, and that I actually do really want to read.
Yeah, that would be fun.
But I don't think there's anything outside of that that's specifically dedicated to their relationship.
That's really interesting then, because like, I was baffled. Like, when I saw there was a prequel to this one, I just didn't understand. Maybe she was working on that one prior, but like, then why would you release them in that order? And why would you end with such a cliffhanger?
Also, yeah, because this ends like well before Attack of the Clones.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's leading directly into Attack of the Clones. It is like not that long. I mean, I don't know. I actually don't know how much time has passed now that I say that. It's not clearly delineated how much time has passed, because she leaves and goes on a recess, and that's when she goes to Alderaan.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like kind of vague after that how long she's been a senator.
This is kind of touching on my lingering questions. I mean, it just seems like a natural segue, but reading this book, I was expecting Sabe to die. I thought the reference to the Queen's Shadow was literally referring to Sabe, and she was gonna die because she was so dedicated to Padme that I just didn't see how you could reconcile Sabe being alive during the whole Anakin thing without stepping in or like interceding or protecting her in some way. And then, so the ending was very surprising to me. And her family, she's got a family. Like, where were they during this entire saga when she's involved with Anakin? Like, yeah, okay. Those were my lingering questions, well, at least three of my lingering questions.
So this is getting into the whole prequel sequel discussion as it pertains to the book, because I was thinking about it, and I really liked Sabe. Like, I really wanted to read more about her.
Mm-hmm.
And I had totally forgotten this, actually. And this pertains to the Darth Vader comic. I was like, oh, I would love to have a sequel to this. And then I was like, wait, a sequel kind of exists. Because the current Darth Vader comic, which I think started coming out very early this year, like maybe in January, there have been two issues that have been released. And I think it's supposed to already be done by now, potentially, but it was put on hold because of COVID-19.
Mm.
So there are only two that are out so far. But the first issue was basically about Darth Vader after he had found out that he had a son, aka Luke, and he is just so angry that he has a child that he didn't know about and that it was hidden from him. So he is basically going to find and hunt down anyone that hid this information. So he goes to Padme's apartment on Coruscant.
Yeah.
And is looking for information about what happened and why she disappeared and who took her, basically, after he saw her on Mustafar.
And wait, what's the time frame for this?
Like, so the time frame is after Empire Strikes Back, I think.
So why does she still have an apartment on Coruscant?
I don't know why no one lives there, why her apartment isn't occupied, because right? It has been a long time.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess we'll just move past that.
Don't question. Yeah. These are not the apartments you're looking for. No one lives here.
So I forget if it's there or in a different location, but he sees someone and he thinks it's Padme.
Oh, it's Sabe.
And like this is like the end of the first issue, and everyone was like, "Oh my God, what's happening? Like, is this Padme? How could it possibly be Padme?" And yeah, it ends up that it's Sabe.
Oh my God! Wow. Well, and when I was reading up about this, like, I didn't realize that Leia had made a reference to, like, seeing her mother and the whole, like, way that that would tie into being, like, she couldn't have seen her mother. Her mother died. But maybe she saw Sabe. So that, again, like, prompted, like, why is there a prequel to this instead of a sequel?
I have never thought about that. And
yeah,
that is a good point.
But then, again, where are Sabe and her family during all this other things that happened? Like, it seems like Padme is so alone in that. Like, it's such a, like, overarching, I guess, maybe if I watch it again, it won't be. But, like, she seems so isolated, which was why Anakin's, like, particular, like, mode of romancing is seems so awful to me, because he's pretty much preying on the fact that she's like lost and confused. I don't know, maybe I'll watch this all with different eyes now that I've read this book.
Well, I mean, by introducing all of these handmade characters and writing about these really strong relationships and friendships they all had and how protective they were of her does introduce some problems.
Yeah, because she seems without a support system. And that is obviously not the case based on this book. In fact, she seems like she has a great support system. And it does, like, this book does explain the fact that, you know, her sister had a child, a partner is optional on Naboo. Like, it explains a lot, like, why she was just totally kosher with being like, yep, I'm pregnant. Guess what? Or, I mean, sort of. She was kind of trying to hide it. That actually doesn't make sense. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I thought it was just, like, after reading
it. I mean, maybe it's because people would ask questions. I guess she wasn't on Naboo, so it's not, like, everyone that was around her would be totally unquestioning about it, necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. They wouldn't have necessarily the Naboo culture of not needing a partner and having a child. But at the same time, like, yeah. I thought I initially thought that would explain a lot, but now that I think about it, it actually raises more questions.
So, speaking of Naboo, another thing that you wanted to talk about was their political system.
Oh my gosh. The amount of times they mentioned the junior legislative program was astonishing. It was so interesting to me the first time, like, I started reading this in the first chapter. I'm like, oh, what is the junior legislative program? How old is she? Like, and if maybe this is getting too much into politics versus Star Wars, but I started thinking about what are the advantages of that? Because my immediate reaction was, no, you can't put 13-year-olds in charge of the government.
Well, they made Padme a 13-year-old queen.
Exactly. And she started the junior legislative program at 8. And it was just like, why would you do that structure? Like, my opinion of teenagers making decisions is so low. And then I started thinking, like, well, maybe that would be good, because they wouldn't be held back by the same sort of, like, caution and hedging of, I don't even know, of adults. Like, maybe it would be better if we were just governed by young adults.
And you would think they would have fewer biases.
Yeah. More inclination to mix things up. But at the same time, like, when I think about the 13 or 14-year-olds in my life and I just imagine them running the government, like, it actually strikes the fear, strikes deep fear into me.
Now I do want to read Queen's Peril, which is the prequel, because I want to know how that actually works.
Yeah.
Does she have advisors that have some influence? Does she have people around her that are also assisting? Or is it just totally her decision?
Yeah, and her handmaidens, and then apparently the captain was another strong figure.
Yeah, I part of me feels like the author just took the junior legislative program and ran with it, because I tried to look it up to get more information, and I really didn't find anything. And through that research, I realized that the first time it's mentioned is in Attack of the Clones, when Padme is talking to Anakin on Naboo, that scene where they're having the picnic.
world.
And he is talking to her about her first kiss. And she says that it was when she was in the junior legislative program.
I love that. But I mean, again, that makes me want to watch the prequels. But also, she would have been, what, like 10?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think, like, that ties into my second point underneath this, like, category is, like, it is advantageous to have these kind of, like, different political structures in a fantasy world, because you actually don't have to worry about how it works. So I have two quotes that are just, like, yeah, this is a miracle, because it's not real. So, like, one of them is, the Naboo had more than mastered efficient democracy, and that was in relation to the voting. And they were like, oh, you know, Theed is the last one to vote, and they have it in by, like, noon. And I'm like, but how? How are they doing this? Like, tell me more about this efficient voting.
Yeah, and
that would be helpful. You know, of our current situation, tell me more. And then the other thing was, Naboo's meritocracy was startlingly uncorrupt, and the truth had always come through for her. And that just seems like, oh, you know, like, unicorns exist. There's no corruption. We've never had to worry about corruption. I don't know why. It's just not corrupt. Isn't that amazing? Like, and I think that is, like, if in a fantasy world, you can just make these blanket statements and no one really questions you because it's your own world. Like, Naboo's great. Without necessarily getting into the nitty gritty of, like, but how did Naboo get this way? Tell me more.
So one realization that I had that shocked me ridiculously was there was some mention at some point of how there were no term limits for the senators. And I was like, oh, yeah. My God, no term limits. How can that be? Like, that's not okay. And then I was like, wait, I live in the United States where there are no term limits for senators.
Right. That was striking to me too. Like, you got this initial, like, gut reaction where it's just like, ah, and then, oh, right. Yeah. That actually does transition. Like, I don't know if you have anything else that you want to talk to about the political structure of Naboo, but that does transition into my next random fact.
Sure.
Oh, so Palpatine's from Naboo?
Yes.
I don't know how I missed that. Like, I was reading this, and I'm just like, wait. Yeah, well, and I mentioned it's Darth Brooks, and he also was unaware. Like, apparently it's a fact that we just didn't really pay attention to, that Palpatine was from Naboo, which is so, I don't even know.
Did you have any thoughts about where he was from, or you just, like, didn't necessarily think about it? Do you think he was from somewhere else?
Yeah, popped out of the ground like an evil lord. I don't know. Like, he was just hiding on these random planets that harbored Sith, and then he just came to power magically as a senator and then assumed the chancellorship. No questions asked. Yeah, so that was weird. So, apparently that was just us, though. That, yeah, see, I'm interested to see, like, yeah, whether or not you actually, like, these were new facts to just us. Apparently that is the case. Or more broadly unknown. Yeah. Are you ready for this next one?
Yeah.
R2-D2 is Padme's droid.
Yes.
What? See, I guess I kind of remember him in the prequels, but he's just kind of, like, disembodied and, like, doesn't belong to anyone.
I feel like maybe a reason you could be confused is that he goes with Anakin in the ship that Anakin is flying.
Yeah. Yes. That's why I'm confused. But actually, that does make sense. Yeah.
But I guess I have to say, now that you mention R2-D2, I am very upset with myself that I didn't include him in my list of favorite characters on our last episode, because he is definitely one of my top favorites and always has and always will be. So I apologize to R2-D2.
I'm also, like, I wrote in my notes, how old is this droid? Which is possibly unfair to R2-D2. He's very old.
I don't know when he was captured.
Function.
It seems like a long time. Like, yeah. C-3PO is probably just as old.
Yeah. Yeah. which is probably is another reason why I associate, like, I was surprised to, like, read about R2-D2 in this particular book because, yeah, I guess I just associate droids with Anakin, like, C-3PO, R2-D2 with the fighter. Okay, so far we established two of my random facts are just very well known and just random to me, but are you ready for this? You probably are, because you already mentioned Breha Organa.
Yes.
She lost her lungs?
Her lungs and her heart.
Yeah! Okay, so I'm sitting there. I just looked this up, because this is, without having any context, I was reading this and just being so confused this entire passage. That mountain is the one that took my lungs and heart, Breha said quietly once her husband was safely out of earshot and engaged in a discussion with Sabe and Marik. From everything I've heard of you, your heart was not the mountains to take, Padme said. Oh, I am sure there are songs about it, Breha said. How I gave my heart to Alderaan, how this time the poets are being literal and a bit gruesome. Though I suppose I am the one who decided not to regrow my skin. And, like, I'm just like, is this common? Like, is this an Alderaan tradition? Like, I'm going to give my heart and lungs to this mountain? No. Like, what? I'm going to skip ahead. It's refreshing to know the elected monarchs and hereditary ones share similar critiques, Breha said. When I refused the skin grafts, they said I was being too showy. The Minister of Culture, sitting to Padme's left, was turning a little green, so Breha changed the subject to spare his stomach. And I'm just like, I was so confused by this. I had to look it up, and I was just like, wait, she lost her heart and lungs? So this would probably be a great time for you to talk about more about your love of Breha.
For sure. So for some reason, knew that. Like, I knew that she had an artificial heart and lungs, and there's a name for it, which I totally don't have in front of me right now. But I didn't even realize that she was going to be in this book. Mm-hmm. And I just think that she is a badass. And
she lost her heart and lungs.
Yes. Like, so the whole context behind that is that
at the age of 16, she underwent her Day of Demands ceremony, during which she claimed her right to the throne by naming three challenges she would have to complete to prove herself worthy. While completing her challenge of the body, Breha suffered a bad fall, and her injuries nearly killed her, if not for the quick action by the guards who were observing at a distance. Although she did survive, her heart and lungs had to be replaced by pulmonoids. Yeah. Unlike most people who receive such mechanized organ replacements, she refused to encase them in new flesh and skin, choosing instead to keep them visible as a reminder that she lived.
Like, she is just so hardcore.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for her.
Well, and that makes Padme's response to her just even more baffling. Like, you know this one lost literally her heart and lungs. You're like, oh, from the stories, the mountain can claim your heart. Like, what?
And she's like, yeah, you're right. It literally did.
Yeah. That's why they write songs. And you know that's not true. Like, it was a weird thing for Padme to say when she's usually so astute.
I mean, I did enjoy seeing them together and their conversation and seeing, like, the two queens discuss and talk about both of their experiences. I did like that. And I also liked that this book portrayed Padme getting to know both Breha and Bail and fleshed out that relationship, because obviously you don't really get to see that in the movies. And, like, there had to be a reason that Bail would be like, yes, I'll take Leia.
Yeah. Yeah. I did feel like that explained it very well. Although, like, I'm still, you know, his explanation for why he followed her into the building when it was about to blow up, that was, like, odd. Even after he explained it, I was just like, you know, it just seemed very convenient and kind of like, what is it? Hand of God, Deus ex machina. Thank you. Literally, I just can't talk. Like, that is my main problem on this podcast, is I just can't speak. To have, like, him be there at that exact moment, and then the explanation following that just seemed a little too pat. Like, it would just makes me think maybe he was there for other reasons. even after he explained it. I'm like, that's it. That's why you just followed her in there, because you knew the building was going to explode and you're curious. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know if you had any ulterior... Oh, I can't speak.
See?
Ulterior motives. Or if that just was a convenient way for them to meet and for her to want to get to know him and trust him.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost seemed like a contrived hurdle to get them to initially meet, and then it was resolved in a contrived fashion. So I wasn't a huge fan of that, but it was nice to see him, because I'm a big fan of who's the actor? Jimmy Smits?
Yes.
Yes. Possibly?
So, yeah. Yes. Yes, that is correct.
Okay, good.
But yeah, I really liked getting to see the Organas. I really liked that she went to Alderaan and we got to spend time on Alderaan. I don't know. I just think Alderaan seems awesome.
Yeah.
And I really think that we need to read Leia, Princess of Alderaan.
Yep. I'm in.
Because it's about Leia completing her challenges.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh, yes. We should totally add that to our reading list, our plan for this podcast. Like, I feel like that would be... I definitely enjoyed this book enough that I'm interested in reading more things set in the Star Wars universe. So,
yeah. Yeah, anyway, that's all I really had to say. It's just that I think Brea is a badass and great, and I prefer her to Padme. Sorry.
No, I don't think you should be sorry for that. It's interesting because, like, everything you say is true, but while I was reading the book, like, even as I was appreciating her and being baffled by the fact she lost her heart and lungs, what? Yeah, I just...
And now in my head, it's like a competition. A competition between Padme and Brea. Like, Leia's biological mom versus Leia's adoptive mom, which is kind of messed up, but...
Well, when you put it that way, it actually makes more sense, because seeing the two queens interact, I was just like, oh yeah, you know, there's no competition here. Like, they're both cool. And also, it was surprising how much I did like Padme in comparison to, say, the other handmaidens, which is, I guess, our next topic.
Yeah.
Like, I had notes. The initial group of handmaidens seemed pretty sweet. So talented, miraculously. Everyone, so talented.
So you're referring to the first group that were with her as queen. So in the first part of the book, like when it opens and they're on Naboo still and it's the day of the elections.
Yes. Yane, Sache, Irite, Rabe, and Sabe. It's also the whole naming convention in Naboo I thought was very fascinating.
Yeah.
Like the fact
that they explained that. They were like, oh, they all took on new names in honor, I guess, of Padme, and they all just end in E.
Yeah. Not to be confusing, which is why I had to take note. And also, it was, while I was reading this, Darth Brooks came up and he was just like, what's Padme's last name? And as I was reading this, I was like, oh. Like, initially, I thought Amidala was almost like a Pope name. Which it kind of is, but also
it is. Just, yeah, it kind her, of is.
Yeah, yeah. Versus, but, like, I was just imagining, like, King Jones and Queen Jones and, like, you know, a last name. But no, it's more of a Pope name where you take it and then you become Queen Amidala because you took that name. Again, where was her family? But it was baffling to me that she had this family, and not only just, like, a family, but a loving, supporting family who were, like, totally on board with whatever she did. And, like, she had a niece, and what happened to them? Lingering questions. So, yes, the handmaidens were not just named to be confusing. They took names in honor of her. And I'm interested to know which ones you thought were more interesting than she was, like, aside from Sabe, which we'll talk more about.
Okay. So, I mean, primarily Sabe, for sure.
Yeah.
I just have some notes about some of the others, which are just things that I wanted to make note of. So this kind of goes back to the depiction of relationships.
Mm-hmm.
There was mention of the fact that Yane and Sache were in a relationship.
Yes.
And it just, like, was not a big deal at all, which I really appreciated. Yep. And, like, there's a mention that I think Yane really wanted to become an adoptive parent.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, in there with that whole sentence that, like, Sache was also going to live with her and they're going to be a family together.
Yeah.
And then
I do feel like they backed away from that, though, because, like, there was those mentions early on that, like, you know, Sachi was blushing or Yane was blushing whenever the other person looked at them. But then, like, as Sachi took the different position, it seemed like there was, like, enough ambiguity there that, like, if someone didn't notice that initially, like, it would be easy enough to be like, oh, they're not together. So I don't know if that was deliberate or not. I have a follow-up point with that.
Yes.
With Sabe. Which, oh, I knew it.
It's probably the same one I have.
Yes. Oh my God. All right. So we'll get to that later. So I that was interesting to me, like whether or not that was like something she would have pushed further or if she was kind of like instructed not to, the author that is. But yeah, we'll talk, I guess, more about that later.
Okay. So one thing that I did think was interesting that pertained to Padme was at one point it went into her thoughts about the decoys and all of the complicated maneuvers. And this was later on after she was already a senator and she was invited to that party where she knew that she needed to collect information. But if she went as Senator Amidala, she was going to have to just kind of sit there and entertain people. Yep. So she did a switch. And there was a passage that I wanted to share about that. Let's see. I'll start here. So her secret shame was how much she enjoyed the decoy maneuver. It was dangerous, only used when they absolutely needed it. They had done modified versions of it several times since arriving on Coruscant, but they'd only done a true switch, one with both Padme and the decoy present. That time when the non, I guess that's how you say that, droid had malfunctioned, a malfunction that still hadn't been explained, though everyone knew the Trade Federation's affinity for droids. Now they would do it again for the sake of Padme's curiosity and political ambition, and even though she was sure it was the right thing to do, Padme wasn't sure she could trust her own judgment.
Mm-hmm.
The ploy put Sabe, who she cared for very deeply, in peril. So many things could go wrong. They could betray themselves a thousand ways, and the damage would be irreparable. And she loved it.
Yes. That was striking to me, too.
So, I mean, that's not something that I think you see in the movies, because, again, we don't get that deeply into what Padme is doing, necessarily, yes, politically. But I really liked that they brought that aspect of it to the surface.
Yeah. It gave her, like, a little bit more depth.
Like, yeah.
You know, she's not just very calculating and, like, politically astute. She has these feelings, as we learn from, you know, the actual prequel movies. But, like, yeah, it was humanizing, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, like, it shows that although she is obviously a very principled, moral person who wants to do the right thing and wants to help others, there is some part of her that misses this whole kind of aspect of subterfuge and deception. And she honestly doesn't have to have her handmaidens anymore, but she does.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, like, I guess this is another reason why I want to watch the prequels again, is they actually, like, her new set of handmaidens, Dorme, Corday, and Verse, do appear in these, like, Rose Byrne.
Yes, yeah,
is like Dorme.
Yeah.
What? I'm like, when is she? Like, I don't even remember seeing her at any point during that film. And so I definitely want to rewatch it and just see, like, okay, assuming that, like, she has these close connections with these handmaidens, like, handmaidens. I'm interested to see, like, how much I notice, like, that I wouldn't have paid attention to otherwise. Like, is E.K. Johnston that evocative? Like, is she, like, building a world where there actually wasn't one and it makes the movies better? Or is it kind of easy to just, like, you know, tell that this wasn't on George Lucas's mind when he was making the prequels and ergo, like, you know, it doesn't add that much depth?
So, kind of a side note, but I did want to at least mention that
that's Sabe, right?
Oh, sorry, yes, Sabe.
Yeah, yes. In my notes, I have, like, I was reading this on my phone, so it was very hard for me to, like, flipping the pages was difficult, and it was very easy to kind of, like, stare off into space and be like, wait, what am I reading again? So on my notes, I have Yane is interested in a house and orphans, Sachi is the youngest and scarred, she's a new planetary legislative assembly member, Irite is the artist who's going to Oto Gunga, and she does the blue-green algae thing, which I thought was super fascinating because I'm interested in, like, agriculture and plants. Rabe was the hair, makeup, and the quartermaster who was going to Thede's Music Academy. And for Sabe, I just have Keira Knightley. And that was easy enough, so I was just like, every single time, like, I'm imagining Sabe, I'm like, okay, Keira Knightley, Keira Knightley, Keira Knightley. And maybe that was the reason I wasn't very invested in her romantic relationships. Yeah. Ooh, we should, transitioning from that, we should talk about the wardrobe, because the wardrobe mistress was fascinating to me. So cool. Like, Rabe and then Dorme as, like, the amount of like forethoughts and planning and like quartermasterly skills that are involved in that is just very interesting to me. And then like the explanations.
So during the first part of the book, again, when she was with her original group of handmaidens that were with her as queen, and they were talking about like her wardrobe and her packing and things that she was leaving or taking, I was just like, this is definitely our jam. Like, all of these things that they were describing as being a way to conceal weapons or a way to provide defense against weapons, like, they're not just elaborate outfits, they actually have a practical use that no one would expect. And I was like, oh yes, this is definitely our thing.
And I immediately thought, like, what was the comic we were talking about where they space her clothes?
That was the Poe Dameron comic, I believe.
I'm wondering too if, like, this kind of, I mean, granted, I'm sure the timeline doesn't work out, that comic probably came out before this book, but I was like, oh, I bet this is why people really are invested. And then I thought about it. I'm like, no, probably not. But it made me more invested for sure.
Yeah. Like, I thought that was so cool. I don't know if I had to guess. I wouldn't think that that was something that George Lucas was thinking about or that the costume designer was thinking about when they made the movies. But for E.K. Johnston to write about how there was another reason for the clothes that she wore was awesome.
Yep. I appreciated that a lot. And I appreciated the fact that, like, the amount of, like, yeah, just the way that Dorme was headed down, like, to an art with, like, the decoy switch was really fascinating to me. And, like, the tone, right? They talk a lot about her voice and how, like, she and Sabe came up with this, like,
inflectionless tone.
I feel like that was, like, so much more interesting and enhancing. Like, it just added another layer to, like, the prequels.
It definitely did. Like, because when I watched the prequels, I have sat there and been like, why does Padme talk like this as queen? Yeah. So I appreciate that there was a strategic purpose for it.
Yeah. Even if it was just E.K. Johnston coming up with that. Like,
right.
Yeah.
But like you said, it does definitely enrich your viewing of the prequels, knowing kind of these, like, behind the scenes things about how things worked with Padme as queen and the handmaidens.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm actually, as I said, pretty excited to, like, rewatch it and be like, okay, this isn't as annoying or as superficial as I thought. Like, there's reasons behind this, even, you know, if that's not what George Lucas was intending. It is now. It's canon.
Yeah. So. However, we definitely will talk about this when we have our discussion about Padme in the movies. But I think once she becomes a senator, they talk in the book about how she tones things down and she has to wear outfits that allow her to move her neck.
Yep.
So I think some of her choices in clothing are still interesting and perhaps not quite appropriate for the situation.
Yes, I know. Now I'm really excited to, like, go back and be like, okay, so with that in mind, do I agree with this? Yes or no? I also feel like it might be harder. Like, I'm talking about this as if it's going to be, like, you know, a lot better to know all this background information, but it is possible that I'm going to watch this and be like, wow, they took this very complex female character and just reduced her into being dependent on this, like, erratic, emotionally manipulative. So I also shouldn't say You can bleep that out.
Yeah, I am definitely interested to go into watching the prequel, focus specifically on her relationship with Anakin.
Yeah.
With all of this as context and background.
Yes. Yep. I feel like it might, like, I might come away from that and being like, wow, E.K. Johnston made the best of a bad situation. And it's just very hard. Like, maybe that's why there's not a sequel to this, is because, like, how do you justify this very, well, this will be great because we're totally going into hilarious foreshadowing. let me tell you, you know, how can you justify these decisions being made by this person who's, like, normally very thoughtful and circumspect, and
I mean,
like,
even hard within the movies, like, it's hard, yeah, even watching Attack of the Clones for me personally to watch how she changes her views from the beginning of the movie to the end.
Yep. So we should talk about this. I'm going to start with my very first one.
Okay. I only have one.
Okay.
So I will let you go first.
All right. So there are two. I'll say the first one because it's very light, and then I'll proceed to the second one because that one's the really, well, not the really funny one. That's the last one, but it is, like, so this is a conversation between Sabe and Tanra, and Sabe's like, she's talking about how she's changed and she's been being, like, more emotionally vulnerable, and he likes it, and she's just like, you shouldn't get used to it. And he says, you can like something even though you know it's not going to last. And then, following up on that.
Okay, this might be the one that I have.
Okay.
So, do you want me to read mine? And then if you have a different one, we can...
Oh my god. Yes, you should read yours, because if it is the same one, I'm going to respond as Sabe. And I'm just going to be like, boom. All right,
so okay.
You should go first.
Okay, so this is a conversation between Sabe and Padme, and they start off by talking about Sabe's relationship with Tanra, and Padme is asking her, do you really like him, and
Yes. What's
going on with that, and Sabe says, I don't know, we've talked about it, so it's not like I'm leading him on, and I warned him a lot, and he's known us for a long time.
Yeah.
And then Padme says, you're protecting him. It wasn't quite a question. As usual, they walked the line of their peculiar bond with perfect symmetry. And then Sabe says, I don't want to be callous, so in a way I am protecting myself too.
Yeah.
Padme finished her own breakfast and looked out the window. It was going to be another glorious day. I don't know what I'd do, Padme said. I've guarded my heart against everything for so long, always aware of the dynamics and the flow of power. I've been lucky to find so many people who understand that and give me that space. I'm afraid that if someone breaks through, I'll let them, and it would be catastrophic.
It's not a reactor leak.
I made a note on this. An understatement.
I deliberately flagged that. This actually isn't the thing that was, like, most hilarious to me, but I did find Sabe's response to be, like, particularly underwhelming. It was, like, one of those moments where it's just, like, really? Like, you are so connected to this woman, and you said, and, like, that's your response. It's, like, it's not a reactor leak. Like, it was an odd choice of words.
Is that what you would say to me?
No! Dear God, no. Like, I would never. I would be, like, you know, you're sitting there, like, bearing your heart to me, and I would be, like, well, it's not a reactor leak. No. But I did find that particular, like, hilarious foreshadowing to be particularly appropriate. Like, again, E.K. Johnston making the best of a interesting situation. So I'm glad you flagged that, because I was, that one did bring a smile to my face. Like, yeah. The thing that was actually the funniest to me was, it was kind of political, but it was basically, like, Padme hoped she would never need to confront something herself to believe it, even if it meant she would face an increase in personal moral discomfort. And, like, in my head, I read this sentence, and then I immediately flashed, like, her and Obi-Wan having that conversation about Anakin killing younglings. And I'm just like, what? Like, you know, she actually did need to be, like, personally confronted with things. And she's like, Annie, no. Like, it was bad. It was bad.
Well, yeah. But, yeah. I mean, I think she was like, oh, no. He would never do this. Yeah. He would never do that. I know him.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting sentence for E.K. Johnston to include, because, like, that does set her up to be, like, you know, I don't want to have to be in these situations. I want to have, like, a clear mind and, like, objective judgment, and that is not the case. Like, she actually... Yeah. The person who...
Oh, yes. Her judgment is weak.
Yeah.
Her judgment is severely impaired.
Yes. So that was... I don't really know the motivation between, like, including that sentence, because I feel like, you know, the previous one was, like, definitely, like, more sympathetic. Like, you could be like, okay, you know, she has this backstory. That all makes sense. But then you throw in this line about, like, not needing to be, like, personally confronted with something and, like... Actually, you kind of do, and that doesn't put her in a good light, and that's a little bit more difficult for me.
So, related to her relationships and her backstory, Yes. There is that fellow senator, Clovis, who is constantly pursuing her, and I have to say, I, like, straight up cackled.
There is cackled? Oh my.
When he tried to kiss her.
Oh my god. That was funny. And he got all bent out of shape. I'm just like, he's in Clone Wars, so he's part of the reason I'm more interested in watching Clone Wars now is because of him and then Mon Moth.
So Asma. I'll read part of this.
Yes,
so
please.
This is after they have gone and done their relief work and have passed their motion, and he is all excited. "You did it," he said. "We did it. Padme was more than willing to share the credit. I couldn't have gotten everything finished so quickly without your insights. I could sleep for a week," he said. He stepped past what her brain would usually consider a safe distance. People always in Padme's personal space.
Yep.
But she was tired, and it took her a moment to catch up. "Me too," she admitted, "but we're going to have to keep going to get everything organized and sent to..." He kissed her, and her exhaustion faded immediately. "No," she said.
Yeah. He was... I liked... Like, it was so interesting the way, like, they described him as a character, too, where he's just like, "Oh, yeah, I'm a member of the banking group, and, like, you know, Moons, that race." And, like, there was this pause, and, like... Padme had to clarify, he's adopted. Like, it's just like, what?
So I know that there was somebody that she was involved with that was in Clone Wars, and I was like, oh no, is it this guy? And I looked it up, and it is in fact him. And I guess this is a good a time as any for us to both say we have not watched Clone Wars. I have watched probably 4 or 5 episodes, and that's it. But we will be watching Clone Wars, or at least...
Oh my gosh, I'm actually a little excited about this. Like, wait, what? All right, yes, yes.
So, yes, I looked them up on Wikipedia, and there was a sentence that said, "The two were romantically linked until she insisted they return their relationship to a strictly professional level. With regret, Clovis respected her wishes."
So that's after this, then.
Yes. And also, I was just like, damn, is this Padme's MO? Resist.
And then
resist
capitulate.
For very, very valid reasons. And then just be like, the hell with it.
Yeah. Oh, that is very interesting. Wow. Yeah. Clone Wars is sounding better and better. Like, just thinking about that, I'm like, okay, I could see where this goes. But yes.
And also, in this article, I just, like, skimmed some parts of it, but apparently there's an episode where she meets him again, and at the time, like, Anakin goes with her to keep an eye on what's going on. He's pretending to be the captain of her ship.
Okay, every single time I think the relationship can't get more problematic, it gets more problematic. Okay.
I mean, one of the reasons that I do want to watch Clone Wars is because I do also want to learn more about Anakin, because also don't really connect with him. So
yeah.
I feel like there's the potential that Clone Wars will endear me to him a little bit more, or at least make me look at him in a different way. So yes. I am excited for that to maybe be the case.
I hope that's the case, because like it was nice like learning more about Padme, and I'm committed to more to her as a character, but I would not say that extends to Anakin even a little bit based on this book. Like, and watching the prequels, I'm sure it's going to be more difficult, as I said, to like handle her engagement with him, because I know she's what she's dealt with before and like what her training is. And then like, apparently he is her reactor leak. And I'm just like, that is not a great term. Yeah.
It's true. I will also have to say in the background, there are fireworks happening outside.
We should talk about one more thing before we end this, because when we were talking about Sabe, we forgot the like very interesting relationship or lack thereof with the Targapian. Which apparently is the first appearance in canon.
Yes.
Yes. I have the quote right here. All right. She didn't always go for non-humans, but it happened on occasion, particularly with interesting females. I read that and I was like, yes! Yes! So, we should talk about non-heteronormative, like, I guess, species? People? In general, because there's so many different races, right? Like, what do I say?
Yeah.
It was surprisingly sparse. Like, when I looked into this, I was like, how novel is this? And it's...
Yeah, I think it is novel in Star Wars.
Yeah. So, in terms of canon, it's actually E.K. Johnston wrote a book about Clone Wars called Ahsoka. I'm sure I'll learn how to pronounce her name, properly.
It is Ahsoka.
Yeah. So, she's Kaden... which I have bad connotations with Kaden.
Yes, right? I feel like this is going to come into the conversation, though. Like, Loya and I are both big Mass Effect fans, and the whole non-heteronormative interspecies relationships is definitely a part of Mass Effect. So I feel like we're coming... to this in Star Wars with the background of Mass Effect.
And the thing is, like, reading what I know about E.K. Johnston, I feel like she also would have played Mass Effect. Like, I'm not sure how much of a coincidence it is that the person who's bi in Ahsoka is named Kaden. Because, like, she references the Doctor. She has, like, this, like, background of, like, very similarly interesting, like, things she's interested in. I feel like would naturally lead her to Mass Effect. So I would have to investigate more, like, how coincidental it is that this person's named Kaden. But her book...
Not what I would choose to highlight or reference for Mass Effect.
Right? But maybe she finds Kaden loving and lovable. So Kaden is bi, but as I was looking into this, Jahani from KOTOR, which I played, Extended Universe, technically Legend, you can romance her. Like, she was intended to be, like, a female-on-female character, but there was a glitch. Or, I've read two things about it. She was intended to be a female-on-male character, and there was a glitch, and you could romance her as a female main character. I will say nothing. Or, she was intended to be a female-on-female character, and you could romance her accidentally as a male. So, either way, like, you could, as a female KOTOR main character, romance Jahani, and it just, like, perpetuated. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. Like, I had no idea because I didn't romance anyone, now that I think about it, in KOTOR 1. But that was, I liked that component of it. That being said, like, Kaden from E.K. Johnston's Ahsoka is really, after that point, is really the first non-heteronormative relationship in the Star Wars universe.
So you're speaking to the heteronormative aspect, not necessarily to someone of another alien species.
Yeah, actually, we didn't even talk about that, but that is a good setup for our next episode. Nope. Episode after that. Just kidding.
Okay, because that's the aspect that I was really...
intrigued by
it. Yeah, because I can't think of any other instances of that in Star Wars. Well, no, that's not true. I think of a terrible example. And that would be Jabba the Hutt.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, and also, like, in the sequels, right? What's her name? Maz, yes! Maz and the Wookiee! Yeah. I feel like George Lucas was a little bit of a prude in that respect. Like, it's not like, you know, Mass Effect, what is it, 2, where there's a human, a Salarian, and a... Oh my god, I'm blanking. Garrus's species is... Okay. Well, regardless, it was all three of them sitting around and talking. Like, it was a Salarian's bachelor party. And they're talking about Asari and how everything about Asari, like, appeals to different ones of them. Like,
Asari are the Twi'leks of Mass Effect.
Yeah! Yes! It's very true. Oh, I bet that's, deliberate. Now that I think about it. It wasn't just, like, coincidental that they kind of look similar. And got some Star Wars fans, I guess, in the Mass Effect, like, programming group. BioWare, good job. Anyways, I actually do still have some lingering questions. Or actually, I just have, like, one.
Okay, do you have any other random facts?
Well, I have a question tied to a fact.
Sure.
Yeah. Why hasn't R2-D2 been translated more often? Like, there's a point where he's just, like, it's after he reports on Sabe and Tanra's relationship to Padme. And, like, they have that conversation that's, like, very deep and profound. And, like, Sabe comes out and R2-D2's standing there. And she's like, you little blue snitch. And he's like, burr, 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 burr. And, like, she understood it to mean all's fair with standard programming. And it was hilarious to me. Like, that is seriously, like, the best. I just want to, like, make that a thing. Being like, all's fair with standard programming. I'm sorry. Not sorry. And so I'm just wondering, like, why there's not more R2-D2 translations in the overall universe. Like, let's talk droid. Well, maybe we will talk droids. Let's talk droid language.
I guess I have a few thoughts on that.
Yeah.
One is that I think R2-D2 is just generally very expressive, even though you don't know exactly what he's saying. And I think you get the sense that he is funny and that he's being sarcastic, which sounds insane because he's a droid that just makes like bleep bloop sounds, but I think that does come across.
Yeah.
And however, there is a video that I should try and find and send to you that someone made that is like a joking attempt to translate what R2-D2 is saying.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And it's hilarious.
I'm in favor of this. You should send that to me because I feel like the more droid like translations, the better, because there's so much to work with.
Really, the last thing that I just wanted to add was that there was a point in the book where all of the handmaidens were hanging out and it mentioned that they had matching pajamas.
Oh my god, no way.
And I just think that we should have matching pajamas.
Yes. I'm in favor of this. Can we have our own logo on our pajamas? Because that would be amazing.
I'll have to look into whether we could produce, like, a small quantity of those or not. And
plaid shorts or plaid pants is what I'm thinking. But plaid in, like, complementary colors.
Or, I guess, we could do, like, an iron-on transfer type of deal.
Oh my gosh, this reminds me of my childhood. Literally... So many. My grandma was so into that. Bears.
Yeah.
More bears.
My grandmother was too. That and like the puffy paint.
Yes! Oh my god, that is exactly it. Wow. Even half a country apart. Nice to know grandmothers stay the same. So my last point, or my last lingering question, was like, why? And Obi-Wan Kenobi not make any impression whatsoever? How?
Yeah, I definitely don't know the answer to that question.
That's my last question.
I asked myself that too. I mean, I know obviously she, again, was not with any of them for very long, but obviously later on she gets to know Obi-Wan much better, and I don't know. I question now, like, when she meets him again, does she remember him?
I'm definitely questioning that too, because like unless as I said, like she had another moniker for him that I wasn't picking up in my search. So like maybe she calls him the apprentice or whatever. I can look that up. But it seemed like she didn't mention him at all. And he was like way closer in age. Like he was there. Like it wasn't like he was just like missing.
No, he was just as involved as Qui-Gon.
Yeah. But somehow the long-haired Jedi, like, made her list. Like, she references, like, overwhelming sadness so many times. And I'm just like, are you overwhelmingly sad? Like, you lost a lot of people in that battle. And Qui-Gon? I don't know. I'm trying to, like, I will try to, like, look this up.
And also, I mean, Qui-Gon died, and she obviously knows that, so she also knows that Anakin is with Obi-Wan.
I don't know. I don't know if she does, because, like, that's what another reason why I'm interested to see, like, Attack of the Clones, because I feel like there's, like, a moment of genuine surprise where she's like, Annie? Like, I don't think she really, like, tracked his progress. I'm gonna look up.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting too, seeing how she talked about Anakin, because she doesn't even really talk about him explicitly. No, she talks about being on Tatooine, she talks about her necklace, but her necklace seems to be more tied to her other experiences there. And there's that whole section where she sends Sabe to Tatooine to try and find, I mean, she is trying to find Anakin's mother, but then she doesn't manage to do it, and Padme is just kind of like, well, you tried.
Yeah. Like, I thought that whole thing was very interesting. Like, I'm just like, you couldn't do anything else? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. She's like, oh, well, you tried. I'm sad that you couldn't do it, but, like, now I need you to come to Coruscant.
And they don't touch slavery for, like, but also, like, I thought it was interesting the way that, like, Palpatine is portrayed, because, like, he always seems like he's, like, 10 steps ahead of everyone else until it's, like, convenient for him not to be, right? So, like, I spent a lot of time, like, second-guessing, like, what's Palpatine's motives in these conversations where he's just like, no, you're not on the, like, slavery committee. You're not here. Like, I feel like she's kind of a loose cannon, and he just lets her, like, wander off. Unless he was, like, I don't know. Like,
that's true. What is his motive for that? Like, why does he care?
Isn't that, like,
why
really
would he be invested in continuing slavery on Tatooine?
I mean, maybe these are questions, like, as we continue our, like, investigation, we'll, like, find out more and be like, well, he wanted there to be continued slavery because he wanted Anakin to turn to the dark side, which was just kind of, like, convoluted way of doing it. And he wanted, like, Shmi? To be, like, taken by the sand people at some point, but, like, he doesn't make sense as a character in general. Like,
you're right.
Half the time, like, he's, like, outthinking literally everyone around him, and then all of a sudden it's just like, but now I'm gonna tell you that if you kill
you're right. They definitely portray him as being the master of manipulation and of having this master plan.
Yep.
That no one knows about, but he is, like, thought out so intricately. But then it's true, like, individual behaviors or actions don't make sense.
Yes. And I feel like E.K. Johnston, again, giving major credit to her, she, like, recognizes that. She's just like, he always had so many plans in place. And, like, she's, like, setting the stage so well. Like, yeah.
I mean, well, definitely, I guess, I don't know if our focus will be on this specifically, but yeah. Rise of Skywalker. Well, that is it for today's show. Our intro and outro music is by Lobo Loco, and our segment break music is by Poddington Bear. You can find us on Twitter at SW Sleepover and on Instagram at Star Wars Sleepover. We are just getting started, but if you already like us at this point, who knows why, you might also consider rating and reviewing us on iTunes or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We will be back next week to continue our discussion on Padme, and we will be looking specifically at how she is depicted in the prequels. Thanks for listening.
And may the Force be with you.